You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Part of the reason I've been spending so much time on the road lately is to follow some of the most exciting science being conducted at labs around the nation and the world. At MIT last week and in Seattle before that, the consensus is emerging that the race to understand the human brain is the most important scientific mission of our time. From the tools we have for measuring what the brain does to our understanding through computer science of the huge information engine that the brain must be to function, to our growing molecular and chemical insights into what nerves and brains are actually doing, this is an exciting moment for the scientists focused on the brain. Just one of the disruptive consequences of this brain science revolution is the way it may soon challenge assumptions about how we teach and learn. This is something that John Gabrielli, MIT's Grover Herman Professor of Health Sciences and Technology and Cognitive Neuroscience, has been thinking a lot about. I spoke with him earlier this month about how our new windows into the brain may demolish the traditional classroom.
Well, I think a wonderful thing about the new techniques is they let us look at the whole human brain at once. And it's remarkably integrative in that way. So with brain imaging, we sort of cover everything from the cortex to motivational and emotional systems. And so I think neuroimaging actually has a potential to make us think harder about the relationships between learning in the book sense that we worry about as teachers and educators and the driving motivational systems and emotional systems that drive intellectual curiosity that lead to higher retention and so on. So I think it's a very exciting way to integrate different aspects of a student or a human learner into a more coherent story and see whether that can make us promote education that's more effective for more children.
Do you think we focus too much on information uploading into students and much less on creating the ideal state for receiving information?
Yes, I think we do, and that's in part, though, because of the measures we've had. So what do we have is standardized testing, and that's typically measuring information that a child has acquired. And it's very hard to make progress in other things without having some measures to tell us if we're on the right track, that are objective, that everybody can agree on. And so I'm hoping these brain measures will give us objective measures of things like motivation, emotion, curiosity that will help us improve practices and policies that promote those things with measurable correlates so that we know we're on the right path.
Brain science tells us that there's a very robust reward mechanism in the brain for the activity of learning, which means in theory that children and students should be getting an extraordinary amount of pleasure out of learning. And so if we're not creating that situation, we're actually working against the brain itself. What sort of reward systems exist to motivate kids and students to actually, and babies, to learn?
Well, we know it neurologically. We know that there's a brain pathway in the midbrain and in the lower part of the basal ganglia that sends dopamine into parts of our brain that help us remember facts. And if that spray of dopamine arrives first into those parts that help us remember information, we're much more likely to remember it. So that says we need to have students in a state of anticipation, of engagement, so that when the information comes in that we want to impart to them to make them more powerful learners, that they're ready to go. And so I think we're going to be using some of these brain measures to help us understand better what are the specific practices that promote that kind of brain readiness for learning.
Objective theories about brains and how they work and how they work socially. If you take a history of science view, many mistakes have been made in the quest for understanding what brains do what and what capabilities are biologically based and what are not. How confident are you that we won't make some of these same mistakes in utilizing these new brain imaging techniques?
I'm quite confident we're capable of making many mistakes. It's very easy to make glib conclusions about these things. I think it's the responsibility of the researchers to be very careful in their claims, to be very precise in their claims. So I think it's quite easy to go wrong on this. I think that happens a lot. And I think how researchers communicate their findings, what's solid, what's speculative, is really important.
Do you think the sample set of babies that are studied, for instance, and brains that get studied in some of these fMRI studies are skewed to one demographic or another? Do we need to have much greater racial diversity in the kinds of people that we study?
It's almost certain. There's not scientific knowledge about this, but all my experience is that it's skewed towards the children who participate because their parents ask them to participate. And that's very much skewed to highly educated, high-income environments where they think it's good to go do a science science experiment. So yes, I think having a much more representative samples in our studies is essential to make the kind of progress we want.
How big of a challenge is making that a feature of the landscape, enforcing it in a sense, having perhaps government created sample sets that have diversity as a criteria?
I think it's a challenge, but I think it's one we have to meet. It's a challenge too because some communities are suspicious. Because of history,
sure,
of bias in research and unethical practices in research. They're very concerned. If you go to a school, a parent could be concerned you're putting my kid in a scanner or some other device. How do I know it's for a benign end and not a malignant end? So I think earning the trust of communities is a big part of this, and there has to be as well as having the support for resources.
You know, again, you've described this as a really important moment in the history of brain science and the potential for tangible social benefits coming from these new technologies. I guess I'm wondering, in your own sort of personal life as a teacher and a scientist at MIT, how is what you've begun to learn about the brain and about how to study the brain with these new technologies change the way you think about yourself as a teacher?
I guess when I began to teach, I teach introductory psychology. You know, I was very concerned about imparting facts and just the experience of teaching as well as being exposed to literature about how the brain works has made me realize how, you know, that's important, it's essential, but that the effectiveness with which children learn at every age is so importantly driven by social cues, motivational states, emotional feelings, and that, you know, you just feel that moment as a teacher when you've got those things lined up that the students want to learn. And when you don't have them, you can have pretty interesting information they don't want to. So that's really made me feel that you have this whole integrated self as a teacher and a student that we need to sort of pull together more. The parts that are easy to measure are the parts that we now think about knowledge acquisition, the multiple choice recognition test. The parts that are harder to measure now, maybe we can really measure them and know how to more systematically motivate students, excite students, engage students.
Not to put you on the spot, but do you think you've gotten better at creating this sort of emotional connection with students in your introductory psychology class to make it more likely that all that stuff's going to line up and give you that experience that you like?
Practice helps a lot, and I've made many mistakes, and I've learned from them. And you know, student ratings suggest I'm on the right track. So practice definitely is. You feel when you're not communicating to somebody that you could have done it better. It's a real signal you get to do it differently the next time.
John Gabrielli, MIT's Grover Hermann Professor of Health Sciences and Technology and Cognitive Neuroscience, speaking with me earlier this month.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.